Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack. I'm Chris. I'm Rick Gray. Today I'll be reading from the July-August edition of Good Old Days Magazine. The first story was sent in by Ray Vickery. It's entitled, An Organized Free-for-All. The best way to play is to play with no rules at all. Kelly Grade School, during the 1950s, was in the heart of Peoria Heights, Illinois, just across from the Pabst Brewery, and a block from the world's best hot dog store called Velvet Freeze. The dogs were steamed, served with raw onions, yellow mustard, and pickle relish, and topped with a secret meat sauce. All of this would be washed down with a large A&W root beer in a frosted mug. Life couldn't get better unless you were playing scrub baseball. I grew up thinking that all boys played scrub, which to me meant a world of lob pitching, no team, no scoring, and no adult supervision. But the two best things about scrub baseball were, one, the number of players wasn't limited to nine. We often had six outfielders, seven infielders, and as many as four or five batters. And two, every kid had a chance to play every position. Most summer mornings after my paper route, I pedaled to Kelly Grade School and headed for the baseball diamonds. A game didn't require a lot of equipment, just a single hardball and a bat. Boys who had mitts brought them, and we did a lot of sharing. Some boys played without. A fielder without a mitt would often use the batters until the owner needed it again. Rules were easy to learn. There were no teams, no innings, no scoring, and all boys, regardless of age, played every position in the field before they batted. The fly ball rule created an exception. When a fielder caught a fly ball, the batter and the fielder exchanged positions, with the fielder passing off his mitt as the player's paths crossed. All other outs would put the batter in right field to start the journey of playing all fielder positions before getting back to the batter's box. Rotation of fielders was important. Everyone started in right field and then moved to center field on the next out. Center went to left field, then from left field to the infield starting at third base. The next out, if not a fly ball, moved the fielder at third to shortstop, then second base, first base, and finally to pitcher. If there was a full field and someone needed to leave, the fielders would shift to fill the vacant position. This meant right field was empty, and the pitcher would declare right field out. That meant that any fly ball to right field would be an automatic out. In that case, the batter who was called out by the pitcher, who in scrub baseball does more than pitch, went to center field to start the fielder rotation once again. The batter's job was challenging. Regardless of the number of batters declared at the start of the game, the pressure built on them to get a hit. Imagine you're at bat and there are 15 fielders waiting to catch the ball. It had better be a solid hit. In that situation, fielders were under pressure too. They knew the play was usually at home plate, where the pitcher would be waiting to make the forced out. This depended on the fielder making a strong throw to home. Without innings, a scrub game could go on all day with varying numbers of players. At the start of the game, there might not be enough players for all positions. In that case, it was possible that balls hit to right and center fields were automatic outs, and there were only two batters. The pitcher barked out any rule changes and declared the number of batters there would be. Some players left at lunchtime, requiring the pitcher to declare rule changes to fit the number of fielders. As the day went on, some players returned from lunch, or new ones showed up to fill in the empty positions. This might cause more rule changes, but it never stopped the game. We often played scrub with just one ball and one bat. A scrub game ended when the owner of the equipment left for a seat at the family supper table. After supper, we had Little League or game of wiffle ball to occupy us. The next story was submitted by Jeffrey M. Smith. It's entitled Isla Mirada Fishtails. Photos capture one catch that certainly didn't get away. My father-in-law, Frank Fortledge, and I shared a special connection. We were both born on October 17th. When Frank was turning 56 and I was turning 23, we had an idea. Let's celebrate our birthdays with a deep-sea fishing trip to the Florida Keys. We waited until December for our escape from Fremont, Ohio's blistery cold in 1973. Frank's travel plans included taking our wives, but our fishing excursion was going to be guys only. We took a morning flight out of Toledo to Miami. My mother-in-law was terrified of flying. She stared straight ahead, gripping the armrest of her seat, while Frank, Fran, and I enjoyed our Western omelets. After landing, we rented a Ford and headed south to the Keys. Isla Mirada was 75 miles away. We had reservations at the Holiday Inn. To save money, we shared a room with two double beds. Frank and I checked out all-day fishing trips and settled on the Barbara Ann 3 with Captain Larry Abel for the following day. We woke up raring to go, anxious to drop our lines and see what nibbled. When the Barbara Ann 3 pulled away from the dock, we were all set. Everything was provided: tackle, bait, and box lunches. First thing in the morning, I was lucky enough to hook a sailfish, but it got away. In the afternoon, our lines were out just trolling when there was a sudden wild frenzy on one line. I jumped down into one of the chairs bolted to the floor. I was determined not to let this one get away. This catch was aggressive. I reeled it in and it took my line back out. This powerful brute had pure stamina. I reeled it in again, then it dove and took my line back out again, over and over. He was a fighter, and he wasn't going to quit, but neither was I. "This angry fish has to be an amberjack," yelled the first mate, watching us intently. After a memorable 45-minute fight, I got it in the boat. I couldn't wait to weigh him back at the marina. Around 4 o'clock, the charter boat started coming in, drawing a crowd. Our wives were waiting for us on the dock, eager to see if we had caught anything. "I caught an amberjack," I shouted from the boat to Fran. After docking, Fran snapped a photo of me beaming, cradling the big lug in my arms before it was weighed. Hoisted up, he weighed in at 62 pounds, 8 ounces, and measured 56 inches long. A 40-pounder is considered a good size. The captains keep records of their boat's catches. I was bowled over when the skipper stopped me and said, "Hey, Jeff, because of his weight, you'll be getting a citation." When I told Fran, she gasped. "You have to appear in court because you caught some huge overweight fish?" "No," I said. "The skipper says it's a fishing award." Frank and I stood next to my catch for more pictures. The skipper yelled, "Hey, what do you boys want to do with it?" If this had been an albacore, we could have eaten tuna salad sandwiches for years. Unfortunately, large amberjacks are wormy and have a strong-smelling, fishy taste. "How about having it mounted?" suggested the skipper with a grin. Frank and I looked at each other. We had lots of questions. After learning more, we decided to have it stuffed. After being out on the boat all day in the sun and salt air, we were wiped out. Plus, I had wrestled the monster. Back in our room, Frank snored like a freight train, but it didn't keep me awake. After 9 months went by and I hadn't gotten the fish back, I thought the taxidermist had lost him, but finally it arrived. The box was the size of a refrigerator. I couldn't wait to open it. There he was, all silvery with his golden sideline from head to tail, and one large yellow glass eye. Frank came over to help hang this heavy dude in my living room. Over the fireplace was wood paneling, and I located the studs. A plaque was included, and we hung this below. I also received a citation with a silver seal reading 39th Annual Metropolitan Miami Fishing Tournament. This catch has been judged exceptionally meritorious. It was printed on heavy aquamarine blue paper, embossed with a leaping silver sailfish. The Metropolitan Miami Fishing Tournament was the largest fishing tournament of its kind for many years in South Florida. The tournaments were known for giving elaborate prizes. A yearbook was put out at the end of each tournament with pictures and lists of award winners by category and weights. This was news to us. At Halloween, we hung the plastic jack-o'-lantern in his mouth, and we plopped on a Santa hat at Christmas time. He became our favorite conversation piece. The next story was sent in by Ramona Scarborough. It's entitled Canning Frenzy. It was more than a pressure cooker can handle. During summers in the 1950s, the women in Vancouver, Washington, went into canning overdrive. Shelves sagging with pristine preserved produce gave most of them bragging rights. Some even turned the enterprise into an out-and-out competition. Our family, along with the rest of the community, began our endeavors as early as possible. In February, the mailman's pouch strap dug into his shoulders as he carried stacks of catalogs for the contestants. My father bought early girl tomatoes to beat Mrs. Higby's fat, slower-growing Bonnie Bests. The new corn hybrids promised Mr. Dolbeck more ears but didn't mention flavor. While frost still covered the ground, we stuck dirt and seeds into open egg cartons, plunked them on windowsills, and waited for them to hatch. I picked the lotus pods off Dad's cover crop and pressed out the tiny black seeds that would be sown next year. He then turned the cover crop under, which would give the new contenders nourishing nitrogen. Mr. Bartlett's truckload of chicken manure for his garden smelled like success to him. A surgeon's care was given to transplanting the baby seedlings in the garden. Investigators often showed up at this juncture. Are those blue lakes by any chance? Are you putting in Hubbards this year? Competition became fierce. Every year the lawns got smaller and the garden plots bigger. Fresh vegetables that matured arrived on dinner tables, but eventually the rest that weren't eaten ended up being jammed into jars and then placed in a wire rack and dunked into boiling water. Cucumbers were submerged in brine, dill, and garlic cloves in ceramic pots, biding their time to become pickles. As soon as the U-Pick orchards opened, fruit frenzy began. Wooden crates of apples, peaches, pears, and plums were loaded into station wagons and pickups. Plucking the ripest produce was just the beginning. More canning jars were unearthed from their hiding places in the cellar or back porch, scrubbed with hot soapy water, and then scalded and set upside down on a tea towel. A controversy about which jar and lid, mason or ball, was superior could cause a lively debate. Now the good homemakers and children were pressed into service. They got out their knives and peeled, cored, sliced, and in the case of applesauce, cooked and mashed. Many a youngster, me included, had purple hands for a week after squeezing grapes through cheesecloth to get juice to mix with pectin for jelly. We roamed the countryside looking for wild berry vines. We'd stick our fingers on thorns and rip our clothes on branches, all for the preservation of our species during the winter. When our kitchen resembled the Turkish steam bath, my mother would gently pull out the wire rack filled with jars, about 10 pounds of weight. She warned all within the haze, "Be careful, this is hot." In the evening, she would listen with appreciation as orchestrated lid pops assured her that the jars had sealed properly. The contents of any failure to seal jar were eaten immediately. Some ladies of my mother's wide acquaintance acquired pressure cookers, so Dad decided he would gift Mom with one. Even after she read the directions, I sensed she was a little afraid of it. She had reason to be. One summer I got hurt, so she abandoned her stove surveillance of the pressure cooker to minister first aid. Kablam! The pent-up steam blew the lid clear to the ceiling. The jars broke and the contents, unfortunately tomatoes, decorated our kitchen stove and walls. When she came back from her Florence Nightingale mission, my mother, who never swore, looked as though she might coin a few new choice, inappropriate words herself. What she did was sit down for a few minutes and view what the pressure cooker had wrought. She scrubbed down everything, and the next year she took out her blue speckled enameled boiler and canned without fear. During the time I was growing up, most of the women we knew canned their own produce. If they did not, they were probably considered just plain lazy. Nowadays, I don't know anyone who cans. Likely, there are secret cells of women in the United States who still uphold that tradition, but they don't advertise. Canned goods on shelves and stores today are not pretty. They are not a source of pride or sign of a hard-working woman. But back then, they were all those things, a special memory preserved in my mind. The next story was sent in by Joseph Utenauer as told to Thomas Utenauer. It's entitled, Freighters Don't Have Brakes, But What If They Had to Jump For It? As I recall, the incident I am about to relate occurred during the summer of 1941 in the small town of Algonac, Michigan. My aunt and uncle owned a nice summer home on the St. Clair River to which their family came each summer. The St. Clair River flows out of the south end of Lake Huron and forms part of the boundary between the United States and Canada, passing between the cities of Port Huron on the American side and Sarnia on the Canadian side. It has a 4 mile per hour current and is 3/4 to a mile wide. A deep channel runs down the center of the river because it is the route that a fleet of massive ships takes to bring iron ore, lumber, and other materials from the upper Great Lakes to the large manufacturing and business centers in and around Detroit. That summer, I had been invited to stay with my aunt and uncle for a few days. One day, my cousin Joe invited me to go out and do some sightseeing from the river, which he knew well. We were both in our mid-teens then. A side note, Joe went on to become a priest in the Canadian Diocese of London, Ontario. We took a small rowboat that had an outboard motor out into the river, and we were having a very pleasant time, with Joe pointing out various interesting places on both sides of the river. Suddenly, without warning, the engine stopped. I suggested that we use the oars to row back to shore. However, we had one little problem. Joe had left the oars on shore. To compound matters, as we were discussing our dilemma, we heard a very loud horn. Looking up, we saw a large freighter coming right at us. We also discovered that lake freighters don't have brakes. We were left with two choices. One was to see if we could get the freighter to turn just enough to miss us. We weren't sure it had enough room in the channel. The other option was to jump overboard and start swimming for shore. I don't remember how far the freighter was from us at that point, but we decided if we needed to, Joe would give the word to jump. There was nothing more that we could do. We just had to watch the bow of the freighter and make a decision when the time came. Then, to our great relief, we saw the bow of the freighter turn to its right ever so slightly. They had enough room in the channel to go by us without a collision. Whew! As the freighter passed, the hull was about 4 feet away from us as we stood motionless in our little boat. We could almost reach out and touch it. A little later, a kind neighbor saw our dilemma and came out to tow us back to the dock. The next story was sent in by James W. Dean, entitled A Fishing Trip with My Dad. Memories of fishing with his dad meant the world to him. The day was dark and gray with a storm brewing in the near distance. The low rumble of thunder could be heard as black clouds slowly drifted by. However, the storm didn't matter to us because my dad always said that the fish bite better when it's raining. On that day, it was true. As the cool rains soaked our clothes and the fresh, clear water dripped from our ears and noses, we caught a long stringer full of gray catfish. My dad sat in the clearing between two slightly leaning but strong and tall river birch trees. He had his long cane pole propped up lightly between the forks of a dry tree limb that he had stuck deeply into the muddy river bank. The thin, almost clear catgut fishing line stretched far out into the murky water and was pulled tight by the river's current. Dad leaned back on the old folding stool where he was sitting, pulled a pack of Pall Mall cigarettes out of his pocket of his well-worn but clean white shirt. He lowered his arm and put his strong right hand into the pocket of his dark blue, sharply creased work pants, where he retrieved a packet of matches. He struck one, and the sharp smell of the sulfur from the match got my attention. I turned and, without speaking, took a long, quiet look at my father. He took a deep, slow draw of the bright white cigarette and then let out a mouthful of misty smoke. The white smoke circled around his black hair, which was combed back with just enough hair oil to keep it in place. As I watched, he leaned over and picked up a can of Black Label beer. He threw back his head and in one long gulp finished off the cool liquid. Then he stood up tall and straight to his full height. He planted both feet firmly into the soft soil of the riverbank. He put both hands on his hips as he clenched the now glowing cigarette between his lips. He looked out over the river as if he were the king of the world. I thought he was. But that day he was just my dad. We talked about fishing, we talked about the river, and about life. It always surprises me how much he could say with so few words. He'd say things like, "Everything in this life will work out. You, son, just have to find out how you're going to make it work out for you." Or he'd say, "When hard times hit you, don't sit down and moan about it. Stand up, tighten your belt a notch, and go to work to make it better." It was on that day that, after I had caught a large eel and was struggling to hold on to it, Dad showed me how to scratch out a long, deep cross into the cool ground with a stick and lay the eel in it. The twisting, slithery thing laid still long enough to remove the hook. I was amazed. Years later, I was outdoors thinking about that fishing expedition with my dad when the loud call of fish hawk overhead brought me back to the present. I was just in time to see a large log go out of sight over a small rapid in the river. This sight took me once again back to our fishing trip. Then I started to remember more of the bits of wisdom that Dad shared with me. We seldom had long heart-to-heart talks, but the things that he told me in those precious minutes in life, when he would look me in the eye and speak from his life experience, have guided me through some very hard times in life. I am the man that I am and man that I have been because of my mama's love and my daddy's wisdom. The next story was sent in by Paula Shepherd Sheedy. It's entitled Moonshot. That history-making moment left a lasting memory that had an impact on all her senses. Days before the first moon landing and Neil Armstrong's small step, there was the initial moonshot on July 16, 1969. I was 18 years old and lived in Indiana. That summer, I visited my Aunt Mimi and Cousin Susie, who lived in an orange grove in the country near the town of Christmas, Florida. Yes, famous for their postmark. I'm not sure I knew that the moonshot was going to happen while I was in Florida, but once I arrived, I knew it was. Everybody was getting ready for it. The town of Christmas is located 20-plus miles from the Kennedy Space Center. I was told that land had been purchased for many miles around the launch area because of damage the sound waves could cause to property. Plus, the rivers and intercoastal water would absorb and slow the vibration of the sound waves. In Christmas, we should feel nothing. The tradition of my aunt and cousin and many other Floridians was to watch the countdown and blast off on TV, and then go outside to watch the real thing until the rocket disappeared into the upper atmosphere. It was always amazing, they told me. The morning of the liftoff finally came. We watched on TV as my aunt and uncle narrated to me what was happening, like they didn't know that we also watched these same launches on TV in Indiana. Finally, the last few seconds arrived. 3, 2, 1, liftoff! There was a huge cloud of white smoke and vapor and an enormous flame. Out of it emerged the Apollo 11 rocket. Then we hurried outside. There it was, bigger than any airplane I had seen in the sky. I could still see the flame. It rose slowly, not rapidly like I expected, for what seemed like several minutes until it was gone from sight. It was as amazing as they had told me. With the excitement of the launch at an end, I decided to take a walk down the sandy country road a mile or so to Susie's house. As I walked, I thought of how impossible the moon trip was. Could they actually land on the moon? Would they be able to return if they got there? What if they couldn't? Would they be stuck? It was surely impossible. As I continued walking, I put it out of my mind to enjoy the peacefulness of my surroundings. It was so quiet. No cars, no people, no noise at all. I was admiring the different plant life while staying alert for any wildlife, like snakes and alligators, when suddenly the ground started to shake. Telephone poles swayed above me. My balance was being affected. So I got down on my hands and knees. I was scared. What was happening? Was I going to die here? The vibration slowed and then stopped. I had survived. I got up and ran back to Aunt Mimi's house. Was it an earthquake? Had something gone wrong with the moonshot? Had it crashed and caused an earthquake? When I arrived, Aunt Mimi was cleaning up some broken glass. Uncle Chet had neglected to secure the china cabinet doors as warned, and one or more of her precious dishes had fallen out and broken. They also had been surprised by the strength of the sound waves. I told them my story of being on my hands and knees and the dancing telephone poles. We laughed and hugged. She said, "You will never forget this visit, and I haven't forgotten." The next story was sent in by Janet Collar, separately but together. The three Collar brothers, that begins with a K, Dwayne, Bob, and Phil, fished together as kids in Indiana. Years later, they planned one last Canadian fishing trip together. They were in a boat on their favorite lake when Dwayne hooked a big one. He began reeling it in, and then the reel suddenly disengaged from the rod. He continued reeling it in while Bob grabbed the rod and held it close to Dwayne as the line was still attached. Theirs was a frantic struggle as they laughed hysterically, but they finally landed the big one, separately but together. The next story was sent in by Diana Johnson, a stick and a string. When my sister Karen and I were growing up back in 1970, I was 9 and she was 10. After we had our breakfast, Mom told us to head outside to play. It was too nice to be in the house, and we were to be back home for dinner. We were usually outside more than inside. We came in only to eat and sleep. Down the road from our house was a bridge. We would find a stick, fishing string, and hook, and make a fishing pole. We would go under the bridge and hunt for crawdads. We'd scream when we caught one and then throw them on the bank. We would catch bluegills and some catfish and bring them home to cook. That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading the July-August edition of Good Old Days magazine. I'm Rick Gray. So long until next time.